broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
The actor's art is to simulate absolutely, to project himself as deeply as possible into lives that are not his own. Within the 3 hours of a drama, an actor must experience and express a whole exceptional life. In these 3 hours, the actor travels the whole course of the dead-end path that the man in the audience takes a lifetime to cover. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. In the first half hour of our program, we're going to talk about the theater, and specifically about the community players of Salisbury. In the second portion of the program, we'll hear a radio drama, The Day Starts at Night, written specifically for Delmarva Public Radio by Sonia Tates, the author of The Watchmaker's Daughter. The play will feature a number of the actors from the community players of Salisbury, as well as others from the Salisbury area. We're fortunate today to have in our studio Tom Robinson, the president of the community players, as well as Ken Nagel, director of The Foreigner, which is currently in production and scheduled for April, and Sharon Benchoff, the director of the wonderfully successful Les Miserables. Welcome to all of you.
We're glad to be here. Thank you.
Harold, we're very happy to be here and very happy to have the continuing partnership between community players and the university and Delmarva Public Radio. This is really terrific for us.
And thank you so much for inviting us today.
Tom, what is the Community Players of Salisbury? I know it has a very long and distinguished history. Tell us about that.
Community Players of Salisbury is one of the oldest community operating theaters in the state of Maryland. And it's been in the Salisbury community for over 76 years. In 1937, 26 charter members started the Community Players of Salisbury. And the first play they did was The Singapore Spider, which was done in May of 1938. And I tried to find out something about the Singapore Spider and could find nothing online that ever existed. The following year, the number of shows produced varied from as many as five to as few as two. In 1964, we started with a major musical production to open the season, which was Guys and Dolls. And ever since then, we have continued with the format of doing a major musical at the beginning of the season and then doing two or three smaller shows during the year.
I think that's amazing. If my reading is correct, you were part of the WPA program, were you, under the Roosevelt administration?
I wasn't personally, but the Community Players was, yes.
Well, you certainly don't look like you were around. You were around back then, but I think that's kind of fantastic, and you guys... You guys helped us pull us out of the Depression, right?
I think so, yes.
And have been going strong ever since.
Yes, we have, yes.
Well, that's really wonderful. I understand that you're a very successful businessman in the area. How did you become involved with this theater group, with the community players?
Well, for years I attended the shows that they did when I first came to the Eastern Shore. And then my daughter got cast as Annie. And ever since then, I've been either on stage or mainly doing sound backstage.
So you first started out as an actor playing roles. Did you have any acting experience under your belt, or was it new to you?
Well, not since high school. I did a little bit of acting in high school, but other than that, it was just sitting in the theater watching the shows.
And like a lot of fathers, you had to follow your daughter onto the stage, right?
Yes, I sure did.
Very good. I know you're particularly proud. The new facilities you've recently purchased. Why did you change? What's your building like, and how are you going to use it going forward?
Well, from the 1950s until about 2 months ago, we were in a facility on Glen Avenue here in Salisbury, and it was about 5,000 square feet. And we really did not have enough room to do a lot of rehearsals, and we were really maxed out on our storage. And so we have recently bought a facility on Nutter's Crossroad, and it's 13,500 square feet, which we are looking to remodel part of that into a place where we can do some rehearsal, much more rehearsal space, and we can also possibly sometime in the future actually do some shows there.
So when are you planning to move in, or have you already moved in?
We moved in during the month of November. We moved all of our sets and props and everything else. We moved into the facility, and we are now in the process of getting together some bids for doing some remodeling of the space.
Well, it sounds wonderful, and it sounds like it'll be a great addition to your group and your ability to build sets and rehearse and go forward with your activities.
It will be a great blessing for us to be able to do rehearsal and build sets and move sets right into our rehearsal space, which we have not had at any time in the past.
In addition to being president, Tom, and a past actor on the stage, the procurer and manager of the rehab of buildings. It sounds like an extensive piece of work that you're doing in your tenure. What other roles do you play in the theater group?
Well, I'm for the major musicals, I've been in charge of doing the sound for that, and I have a very good team. I have about five people that work with me, but when we did the recent Les Miserables, it was a major deal where we had 50-some people mic'd at one time, and so that was a real challenge for us, but we've really enjoyed doing that.
Well, I know that your business is the poultry business. How does the poultry business translate into miking 50 people on the stage and managing all the technical aspects of the sound of a production, particularly like Les Miserables?
Really does not. I mean, poultry does not have anything to do with theater, but I enjoy it kind of as a part-time something to do in my spare time.
And well, poultry isn't something you
no,
do in your
poultry
spare time.
Is a full-time job.
But how did you come to learn the technical side of miking people up and running sound equipment?
I've been all over the country taking classes of everything from California to Texas to Rhode Island to Georgia, and have taken a lot of classes at different facilities.
Well, your role of technician moves us into the area of theatrical production, and Sharon, you were the director of a very successful run, I understand, of Les Miserables. I would suggest that is an incredibly ambitious undertaking. Is this the most extensive production you've undertaken?
As a director, most certainly. I've done directing of comedies, dramas, farces, but this is actually the first musical that I have ever directed.
How did you learn to be a director in the theater? What is your background?
I studied at Salisbury University, received my degree in theater and education under Leland Starnes in the 70s. So I took all of the classes, acting. Early on in my career at the college, I discovered I was a much better technician than I was actress, so I went down that path.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the quote I paraphrased from Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus, at the top of the program, Camus says that the job of the actor is to project himself as deeply as possible into lives that are not his own. It is to experience and express a whole exceptional life. As a director, how did you motivate and direct your cast to assume the lives of these French people in revolt in Les Miserables? How did you work with them to actually become other people for that production?
It actually began before we had auditions. I made certain that I read the novel. First of all, I used it as a textbook with the different characters, what was going on historically in France at that time, the background, so that when I cast the show, I was able to speak with each of the main actors that had the leads, letting them know who their characters were, where they came from, the era that they lived in. I also met with all of the cast, which was 70 people that we had in that cast, and told them somewhat of the background, that it began in 1815, so it was slightly after Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. Why are they poor? What happened to their families? If you're a young teen, where are your mother and father? Were they killed in the war? Are you an orphan at this time? I let them know that the average age expectancy was 47 at that period of time, and quite a few people were surprised at that. So I think giving them the historical background of what was going on during that time helped them learn who they should be and who they should become.
What did you do while they were on the stage? Did you do much directing while the rehearsals were going on?
Again, this started before we even had auditions. Before I even knew who was going to be in the parts, I met with my set designer, Ken Johnson. We had the set design, so I knew exactly where everything was going to be placed. So I actually had the blocking worked out before we even held auditions as to where the actors were going to be standing, where they would be moving, on what line in the song, when they would exit, when they would enter. I believe in giving my actors the basics and the framework and the foundation of who they are and what their motivation would be, and let them work out where they think their character would go at that particular point. If during rehearsals I find that they're not understanding the line that they're saying, then I step in and meet with them and talk about interpretation.
What was the greatest challenge that you faced in producing and directing Les Miserables?
Time. Time was by far the biggest challenge. We have 8 weeks from when we receive the materials to rehearse and get that on stage, whereas professional productions will have months to prepare. I always wish I had more time just to tweak things a little bit more, make it a little bit more perfect than the way it was.
You put all this together in 8 weeks. That just seems amazing.
It is pretty amazing that we all work together. It's certainly a fellowship where we all work together to reach that end goal.
Who did the dancing for you? Who did the choreography for the movement on the stage, which I understand is very important for Les Miserables?
I took care of the movement on stage. There are two essential dance numbers, the Innkeeper's song, So Robin Finley was my choreographer for the Innkeeper song and also for the wedding where we had dancing. So she was the choreographer for those two numbers.
Just a huge amount of work involved. Are you going to bring this Les Mis back again at some time in the future?
Oh.
Or you hope not?
You always need to step away from your most current production for a while and let that simmer. I certainly loved working with all of the actors, the cast, and the crew. I would not be opposed to that, but as you say, it is a great undertaking to bring all that together.
Let me ask you, Sharon, a somewhat more personal question. What skills do you think you have as a director and that you brought to bear on putting Les Miserables together?
I think what I'm lucky to have, and I don't know that it's a skill or if it's something that I was born with, is the ability to see the finished product in my mind before it hits the stage. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that I'm a lighting designer. And so I can see what the finished product is going to be. So having that in my mind's eye, then I will be able to move the people around, the set pieces, right, that sort of thing.
Well, how did you go about selecting the cast? And I'm assuming this might be kind of a general approach that the community players take, but how did you go about getting all of these people, lining them up, and evaluating their capacity to perform before a live audience?
What you said is true. We have open auditions for all of Community Players Productions. We have the dates announced on our website. Sometimes we put an ad in the paper. We put it on Facebook, emails. We actually had 180 people audition for Les Mis. Originally, I was thinking of casting around 50, but there were just so many that were so talented that I couldn't get below 70. As the director is there, the producer is there. We always have a player's member from the board at auditions to make certain that everything is run fairly and everyone is given an opportunity to sing or to read. We have, of course, the musical director there when we are doing a musical. So everyone has that opportunity to read and to sing, and then that core of persons gets together, and then we reach the decision of who should be cast.
So who is the core, again, that you
For
have?
The musical, it would be...
We want to know who make the decisions here.
The buck stops with me, as Harry Truman would say.
Okay.
So I would have the final decision and who would be cast.
And the others who would be involved in the evaluation process?
Absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. Everyone brings their ideas and their thoughts to the table. And we actually have evaluation sheets.
And that's the musical? Musical director and who
else? Producer,
and the producer.
And usually the choreographer as well.
All right. Well, it certainly had a wonderful run, and the reviews of it were terrific, and you're to be commended on such a prestigious and ambitious undertaking, I think, and doing it so successfully.
Thank you very much.
Kel, your turn is coming up, I understand. You guys are getting ready to do, they're playing our song, which... granted, is a bit different from Les Miserables, but tell us about their playing our song.
Well, we like to have a varied season, so we're going from a very serious, beautiful musical to a musical that's a musical comedy. It's a funny show, it is a romantic show, and it is in production. Sharon said we had 8 weeks to get ready for Les Mis. In actuality, Sharon lived with Les Mis for most of a year. I know her very well. She spent a lot of time thinking about the show before we ever had auditions. Nevertheless, we closed Les Mis on the first Saturday of November, and on the first Monday of November, Sherry Trader-Hines started auditions for their playing our songs. And that show is now cast and in rehearsal. Basically, it is a romantic story of Marvin Hamlisch and Carol Bear Seger, who were... musical writing team who became romantically involved. Marvin was already successful. Carol came to bring him some lyrics, and she brought great lyrics. They fell in love. They had a rocky on and off affair for years, and that's the story. I was on the production committee, which read scripts, deciding on the season last year, and so one night I'm reading the book of their playing our song, and about 15 pages in, and I said, "This is really funny. Who wrote this?" And I turned back to the cover page, and it was Neil Simon. Right. So it is a funny book, romantic story, some good tunes. We have a nice cast. Sherry is a veteran director, and I think everybody will enjoy that show, which runs from January 24th and 25th, and then January 31st and February 1st at Warwick. And, of course, all those tickets are available online on our website, www.communityplayersofsalisbury.org. So Sherry's going to finish that on February 1st. On February 3rd, 4th, and 6th, I will have auditions for The Foreigner.
Well, let's... Let's stay for just a minute on their playing our song.
Absolutely. Sherry would love it if we did.
I see a progression here. I see a very serious Les Mis, if I can use the shortcut, for Les Mis, and then I see a little lighter approach. Mm-hmm. Did you simply feel that people needed a break from the drama for a moment?
We like to have a balanced season. The production committee and the board do try for that. So we're going from sort of a very serious musical drama to a light musical comedy to a silly show. And then which is The Foreigner. It is a very...
Okay, well, we're going to talk about The Foreigner.
I'm just talking about the progression of the season. So we're going to a sillier show, and then back in June to a more regular Neil Simon comedy, Brighton Beach Memoir. So we really, really think we have a nice season.
Oh, I think you have. I think you have a wonderful season. And I understand that they're playing our song was a Tony winner as well. So it's a fairly well-known and fairly popular show.
I think originally Robert Klein and Lucy Arnaz.
No, I think you're correct. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's a good show. So it is. We have two strong people playing those leads, and then three male chorus and three female chorus. One of the females, I believe, is Miss Katie Sims Parsons, Tom's daughter.
Oh, is that your
who played Annie
who
years
was Annie?
Back?
Yes,
who played Annie? And in that show, I played Bundles the Laundryman and carried Annie off the stage in a laundry bag.
Oh, listen.
She's a big girl now. I can't do that anymore.
I think that's going to be a terrific show, and really, really look forward to it. But as you said, you go from the serious Les Mis to a little bit lighter a musical. They're playing our song, and then to The Foreigner. Yeah. Tell us, and The Foreigner, it looked to me to be just sheer farce, and looked to be unbelievably funny and exciting. So, and you're directing that. I
am directing that.
So tell us
about
The Foreigner.
It's very funny. Is it a farce if nobody runs around in their underwear? I don't know. So we don't have underwear. But other than that,
well, you could, as far as I can
won't.
Tell.
Okay. We won't. We will have a nightgown, probably. It is a very, very broad comedy. And interestingly enough, one that at the end, the audience will say, well, there was a message there. There was a message there on how we deal with foreigners, how we deal with people who are of other cultures, of other whatever. Religious persuasions, races, anything, because the people in this play deal with the foreigner as a stereotype. And over the course of the play, everything changes. But it's not preachy. It can't be preachy because it is too funny. You don't see the message till the end. Interestingly enough, this whole thing takes place over 2 or 3 days. And most of the characters actually change. They're written as stereotypes. Catherine is the spoiled Southern belle heiress sorority type at the beginning. And by the end of the 2 days, she has changed. She realizes things about other people, realizes things about herself. Charlie the foreigner goes from being a total introverted schlub to somebody who finds his own personality in his late 40s. The two evil characters are, they start out, they don't really change, but they start out being sort of regular Southern people, one an intense redneck, but over the course of the show are revealed to be hypocrites and then evil. That's if you think Ku Klux Klan people are evil. If you like Ku Klux Klan people, you won't like the way we deal with them.
Well, that was partly why I called it a farce. Yeah, you don't have people in underwear, but you do have people in long white.
We're going to have sheets.
We are in long white sheets.
Yes,
and
we are.
That in today's world, it wasn't at one time, but that in today's world is definitely farcical. Let me ask you. What challenges as the director of The Foreigner do you find?
First, I have to have a cast. But I'm sure we will find a cast, but I'm going to say the audition dates again. February 3rd, 4th, and 6th. And the characters we need are one young Southern belle, her younger brother, who is sort of a dimwit, who turns out to have more talent than anybody expected, Charlie, the lead, and his buddy Froggy, who are two men in their 40s. The young preacher, who is engaged to the Southern belle, he's around 30. And a rural Southerner who could be anywhere really from 35 to 60. And then an elderly woman who owns the fishing lodge where the story takes place. I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to find a great cast. And I'm pretty sure we're going to have competent direction and everybody will enjoy the show. Well, the challenge will be for the actors to start on page one, where they are written as stereotypes and wind up being different people for curtain call. And that's the way the show is written. It's very funny, and I'm sure we can pull it off. I've seen a couple of community theater productions of The Foreigner. I haven't seen it done professionally. It's a very, very funny show, and I'm anxious to do it.
Well, there's no question in my mind that you're not just going to pull it off, but that you're going to do a great production. You've got a wonderful vehicle to work with, and certainly finding a cast and making the evaluations and the decisions. But once you get people on the stage, and you're the director, your job doesn't stop, does it, when the actors start in rehearsal? And what do you see as the challenges that you're going to have with these actors trying to play these various parts?
Sometimes the challenges, and certainly it has been when Sharon directed me, is getting people to stay in the light. So there are little challenges, making sure that they actually go where you want them to be and speak the volume you need to have them speak at. And then there's intonations and there's line reading. There are just so many things that go into how a character is played. And the costume can make a huge difference in a character. I mean, if we dress the Southern Belle up in white or red, that makes a difference. Okay? All sorts of things
I've
like that.
I've never heard of a Southern Belle in red, but...
Well, you won't this time either.
I didn't suspect so. Well, Kel, it sounds as though you've got an interesting challenge in front of you, because to be funny is almost more difficult than being serious. And I think you've got a good play to work with here.
I sure think so too. Can I plug Brighton Beach for Daryl?
Please do.
Daryl Mullins, who is actually a communications professor over here, and who just did an outstanding version of Company at the Black Box at Fulton last week, is directing Brighton Beach Memoirs for us. That is a Neil Simon show. It is a coming of age show set in Brooklyn in I think the 30s, 40s. It is one of his trilogy that went along with Bloxy Blues and the one I'm forgetting. It is a very funny show, okay. And Daryl will do a great job with that.
Well, let me ask you very quickly. How do you get tickets? And if one wants to become involved with the community players of Salisbury, how does one go about doing that? Obviously, you can answer a call for actors, but how do you become involved? Set, building sets, doing artwork, however, what should they do?
The easiest way is to go online in communityplayersofsalisbury.org, and you will be able to see a lot of things. Tell us you would like to get some more information. We'll be glad to send it to you. If we know you are interested, you can become a member. You can get on. You will get our newsletter that comes out about 9 times a year, and that way you can keep involved and find out what shows are happening and when auditions are.
There are links to the board members' emails on the website. It's easy to get a hold of us.
Well, Tom Robinson, Sharon Benchoff, and Kel Nagel, thank you very much for joining us today on Delmarva Today, Writers Edition. What wonderful work you're doing. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with Sonia Tate's original radio drama, The Day Starts in the Night, written for Delmarva Public Radio. Sonia's play is based on an incident involving her father while he was interred in the Dachau concentration camp during the Second World War. You won't want to miss it. We'll be right back.
There is a place on your radio where all of your musical tastes are indulged. Hi, I'm David Dye, and on the World Cafe, we specialize in hard-to-define artists like Nico Case or The Decemberists or Ryan Adams, artists who live in the musical cracks. In conversation and live performance, you hear the musicians who are shaping our cultural landscape. Join us as we make sense of a world of music on every World Cafe.
Weeknights at 7 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Now, The Day Starts at Night, an original play written for Delmarva Public Radio by Sonia Tates, author of The Watchmaker's Daughter. Sharona Gilson is wiping her hands on her apron. She inspects the table laid for the ceremonial Passover meal. The traditional round Seder plate sits in the middle of the table. Circled around its perimeter are a lamb shank, the sacrifice of Passover, a baked egg, symbol of eternal life, a sprig of green parsley to celebrate the renewal of hope, and in the middle of the plate are the bitter herbs, which represent the bitterness of slavery. Near the Seder plate is another silver plate, rectangular and covered in a silk cloth. At one end of the table, there is a large silver goblet with a pattern of grapevines. At the other end is a 5-branched candelabra, which holds unlit white candles. Satisfied, Sharona runs her fingers across the brilliantly white tablecloth, waiting to receive the place settings. The room is brightly lit, and 3 children bustle to set the places.
Okay, the Seder plate looks good. Jesse and Sophie, put the silverware around like I taught you. Then Daddy will put the matzahs out. Hannah, your dress is lovely. That length looks good on you.
What time did you say they were coming?
7:30. But remember, they're German. The bell will probably ring at exactly 25 after.
What's that supposed to mean? Anyway, their plane could be late.
No, they're already here. Remember? Mom said that they could stay with us, but they wanted to visit the city first.
I hope they don't find people rude here. New York isn't the kindest place. And we don't know them. Why are they coming to see us anyway?
Honestly, Sophie, we're not here to impress anyone. They wrote to us. They wanted to meet us. So they're coming, okay? Don't be antagonistic. Just be your nice self.
The smash of cultures. The war of worlds. The dark past walks in the door.
Look, you 3, the war is long over. Papa and Greta are gone, and their parents are dead too. But if we can celebrate one positive thing.
Here it is. I got a huge box from Israel. More unleavened bread than anyone could eat in 40 years in the desert.
I could eat them every day, Daddy. They're amazing. Like water biscuits. So elegant.
Well, they're supposed to be the bread of affliction. So try not to enjoy them too much. The bitter herbs should help.
Even though it's supposed to remind us of hard times, I love that horseradish too. Did you ever eat it plain? It's crazy.
John, did you remember to get the handmade matzah too?
Oops. What, handmade? Just kidding. Of course I did. Do you know how expensive that stuff is? Exorbitant.
Especially when you consider that half of it looks burned, like old parchment. And what are the ingredients anyway? Wheat, grain, and good old H2O. It's not like you need truffle oil.
Crushed grain and water. No more, no less.
Well, put the machine-made ones on the plate in the middle and cover them. I'll get a platter for the handmade.
And baked for exactly 7 minutes, right? The timing is crucial.
Speaking of time, there's the bell. They're here.
Ha, look at that. 7:25 exactly. My father was the same way, always punctual. But then he was a watchmaker. Lived in a world of seconds, minutes, and hours, measured by little whirring wheels and gears. I'll get it. Welcome. So nice to have you here. You must be Fritz.
Yes. Fritz Konkelstein.
And your wife is?
Elsa. My name is Elsa Konkelstein.
Well, come in, come in. As you can see, the table is all set for a wonderful meal, and we're so glad you could join us.
Mommy, should I fill Elijah's cup now?
Yes, sweetie. Get the grape juice.
Very delightful. Very, very homelik.
May I also say ravishing. I studied for some years in advanced English. Yes, the scene here is ravishing.
Hey, Sophie, careful with that juice. You're spilling.
I like to always fill it to the brim.
For who? The imaginary Elijah?
Sometimes he actually drinks a little. You just don't notice it the way I do. If I fill it all the way, I can tell.
I know maybe who is this Elijah. I was reading your booklet, your Haggadah, I think it's called. It explains exactly the order of this ceremonial meal.
That was very thoughtful of you, Fritz. I may call you Fritz?
Of course. And you'll have an extra cup of wine for this prophet, correct?
Yes, wine or grape juice. We'll all drink 4 cups of wine or grape juice tonight. And we imagine that Elijah is also a guest at the Seder. It's like he's helping us usher in a time of peace.
A messianic time, you know. The lion and the lamb.
I love that. No violence, Daddy. The poor lamb is safe.
Not that you're the lion or anything, Mr. Kolkenstein. At least, not anymore.
The Lion of Judah is a very fine symbol, I think, too.
Very nice. Very fine. She's being so careful, your little Sophie. And you, little one, you are now going to light these candles here soon. It's getting dark.
It has to get darker. The new day begins in the night.
What a fine candelabra. Silver?
Yes, it was Jonathan's grandmother's. She brought it back from Russia.
Mommy, I think one of them tipped when I poured the juice.
Just straighten it a little, Sophie. You'll help too, right, Hannah?
I'll get the kitchen matches.
So on Sabbaths and on holidays like this one, we light candles in the evening. And the glow, it's very meaningful to us. That there is light in the darkest of times, and we keep it lit, you know?
Yeah, I do know.
Actually, what do you know?
He knows what we mean, son. That's why he's here.
Does he know how many of our family were butchered in the...
Mom, is this... Aren't they the good people's children?
Yes, I told you, sweetie. Fritz and Ilsa, they're good people.
Elsa.
Yes?
You say Ilsa... It's not important, maybe, but I am called Elsa.
Sorry, Elsa. And where are my manners? This is my daughter, Sophie, and her big sister, Hannah, who's getting the matches. And my son, Jesse, and that's my husband, John. He's just bringing out a platter for the special matzah.
Voila, everyone! Handmade matzahs. Just the way we like them, slightly curled, burnt dark brown at their edges.
Oh, amazing! Wunderlich!
Silver like this, so much and so fine. You don't see...
Nein, I meant the breads. So lovely, so traditional.
A John. I think Fritz knows exactly what they are.
But he called them the breads.
Nine. I mean, but of course, Natalik. I meant the special breads, what my father told me about.
They were special. They still are. And so was your father. Did you know him, Elsa?
Yes, but not for very long. He was not a very healthy man, and I think he smoked too much the cigarettes. The beer did not help matters either. The poor soul.
I'm confused.
Let's all come to the table. Thanks, Hannah. Just put the matches here, just by the candles. Good. Thanks, sweetie. Fritz, I want you to sit at the head of the table. Your wife to your right. I'll sit on your left. John, you sit opposite Fritz. Kids, just sit. It's all good.
Mom, who are you? You're acting weird.
You do have a weird glint in your eyes, Mom.
You're both being so insensitive. Mom is almost crying. There's a reason.
It might just be the bitter herbs. They send out fumes and my eyes.
No, Mom. I want them to hear it. Your father was in a concentration camp in Germany. Dachau. He almost died there.
They know. Fritz knows.
But he survived. And he came to America. And that's how you were born. And we were born.
And Fritz's father. Fritz, why don't you tell the story? Our story of enemies in wartime.
I will explain, as I heard it from my father, who was then a guard in that same concentration camp. It was the holiday we have here, your Passover.
It's yours too now.
The room is in shadows now. Night is falling. It is Dachau, the first concentration camp in Germany, a school for violence for the SS men who command it. Over 200,000 people would be imprisoned here and in its subsidiaries. Over 41,500 would be tortured and murdered by the insane who are running the camp. In the shadows, we see Wolfgang Kunkelstein, Fritz's father. He is a guard in a Nazi uniform, standing at the door of a wooden workshop. Inside the workshop, there are nine men bent over their tables, working on watches and clocks. In the foreground, Sharona's father, David Shimonas, faces the guard. Though emaciated, he stands erect, proud. The prisoner's striped pajamas hang from him like rags.
Now you sit! Sit and yest!
I am standing to say something.
No! It is I who say things here. Verstaden! I am here to say that you have not eaten your rations today, and not yesterday. Not that I care if you shrivel up. But to waste bread is utterly forbidden.
I can't eat it.
What are you talking about?
It is absolutely forbidden.
Verboten? By what authority?
Have you not read the five books of Moses in your Bible? Look in the second book, the book of Exodus. We Jews were slaves in Egypt. But the strong hand of God set us free in the end. To remember this...
Of course! I remember this.
No. To remember this, we are commanded not to eat bread for 7 days, the entire Passover holiday.
Not that I care, but the watches, the clocks. You cannot starve. You must work.
Yes. Arbeit macht frei. Your concern as to whether or not I starve is... Well, we agree. I don't want to starve either. And God commands us not to eat bread. But the bread of Passover is the unleavened bread, the matzah. That is the word in the language of God. Matzah is what we baked when we fled our captivity in Egypt. No time for the bread to rise. It is flat and humble, but it kept us alive to this day.
What did you call it?
Matzah.
Matzah, ratzah, katzah. It's all gibberish. Your Yiddish away.
My Bible. All the words in it, it's yours. And I respect my orders as you do. I can't do otherwise.
Not under these circumstances. What do you suggest? Do you want me to report you? Have you killed? The gas chamber can take another subhuman like you any time. It doesn't care.
Yes. I'm at your mercy. That's how it is. You are the human, and I the Jew.
That is how it is. But even for a Jew, you are not a bad man. So why make me report you?
A man. I try to be a good man every day.
Well, your work is quite good, at least. Respected, even. But that doesn't mean...
I was once a master watchmaker with a shop of my own and workers. I had a Harley Davidson. One of your friends is probably riding it now. I'm still proud of my craft. I take sick and dying hearts and I make them tick again. To measure the right time, the rhythm of the universe.
Yes. Your time fixing is impeccable. For my uncle, the Commandant, you corrected a wonderful repeater, very complex, with the moon phases all as they should be.
And the calendar in that clock says that it's now my holiday, my festival of freedom. And so...
So celebrate your freedom in those prisoner's pajamas. Go ahead!
I can't.
To make any bread, you need wheat, yes? Even your flat one?
That's right. The staff of life.
Good wheat. And maybe oil, eggs, a pinch of yeast. Oh, soon. Soon, my Lata. Oh, she makes sometimes for Easter such a bread that you put in egg yolks and sugar and...
No eggs. No sugar. Just the meal and the water. And a clock. You need a clock. Timing is important.
For this bread of yours, you mean?
For the matzah of Exodus, yes. For this time in the calendar. Passover and Easter. They're at the same time.
And a clock I need, too?
Here. Take this little clock. Take it home. Take it to your wife, to Lota, who bakes so well. It will tell you when it is time to take the grain off the fire. Then she will have made, for the first time, the most precious and rare bread of all. A bread that instructs, brings you to God. The bread of affliction.
How does it taste?
You will see. To me, it tastes like honor, like freedom. Only a taste. Only to obey, not to stuff my body. Just one flat piece. We'll share it. To show that I and my fellows here...
Fellows! Stop! I have heard enough from you, Jew. It is true what they say. You are very clever. You almost had me fooled. A bread that brings you to God? Ha ha!
I haven't said anything new. It's in that book. You can read. It's old, too. Older than the Reich, even.
Enough! Shut your clever Yiddish mouth and do not talk anymore. Get to work! Now! Because this whole time you've been gabbling like we're equals. Equals! What a thought. You are nothing to me. And I called you a man. Ha! I can turn you over any minute. Any minute on those clocks and watches of yours. I can stop your life in an instant. When I choose. When I say it is time.
The candles glow in the dining room now, illuminating the faces around the Seder table and the gleam of Elijah's silver cup.
Blessed art thou, O Lord, sovereign of the universe, who has sanctified us through good deeds and commanded us to light the lights of this holy day. This is a terrible story and a wonderful story too, Mr. Kunkelstein.
Life is like that, isn't it? Affliction and wonder. Not just for the Jewish people, for everyone.
Well, don't stop there.
We stopped to light the candle.
It was getting dark. Before darkness fell, we needed to make the blessing.
It's a scary time to stop.
David Shimonis is asleep at his workbench. His head lies on his arms. Wolfgang Kunkelstein strides to the workbench, his arms wrapped around a bag. David's face is white as he pushes to his feet, facing the guard.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't sleep at my workbench.
You sleep maybe because you're hungry.
Yes.
Which is your fault? Your responsibility. Insubordinate Jew. Do you know what happens to insubordinate Jews? What have you to say for yourself, rebel?
I will be more awake. I will work harder.
I wanted to report you. But you are a good worker for a Jew. And when you don't sleep at your bench, so here is your bread, your matzah.
You brought the matzah. You know what that could mean.
This is a risk for me. But it is small. My uncle, remember. The commandant. Just don't make anything of it. And the baking? It was easy, like you said. But my wife, my Lata, she was quite upset.
I'm sorry.
Don't apologize when you don't know anything. She was upset because she is proud of her cooking, her baking. And she said, so dry. You could choke from it, so dry. No one could eat this kind of bread without something. So, here. She gave me also some strawberry preserves. I think they are excellent. From our country home, not far. This summer there were so many, you know.
You brought them here for me and for us?
That pathetic bread. For life. The strawberry preserves. A moment of sweetness. For hope. For you. For these fellows.
The night has come full on now, and the dark is enveloping the dining room. The candlelight all the more beautiful for it, and necessary. Each face is glowing.
That was my mother. You know, always saving the fruits, the tomatoes, preserving all the goodness of the earth. And she would make such pickles.
Kosher dills?
No, I don't think so.
She didn't like me much, though, your mother, Lota.
When you met her, she was old. And now she's gone. And Papa, too.
He was a big drinker and a smoker. Who lives forever?
Your Papa was an incredible person. Matzah, strawberry preserves, the risk. His commandant uncle would have sacrificed him in a moment. Your father, I feel him here.
In spirit, you mean? Should I check Elijah's cup?
Now you're really stretching it.
Did your father ever talk about this story?
Nein. He told me this story once. Then the cancer came. It was a small candle lit in the darkness of hell, he said. That was all. After that, he never told it again and never talked about the war at all.
Yes, but maybe there were hints, you know?
What do you mean, hints?
One time, when he was really old, he started to cry that he was bad and going to hell. You know, in the hospital, after the cancer, I was there, Fritz. The nurse was coming over with the shot for him to make him stop.
Poor man. He was so skinny. We were even joking that he looked like a...
Like a what?
No secret. He looked like a camp survivor, all right? He was dying. And here this man, who was once so tall and straight, was crying, frightened. So I said to the nurse, halt! Stop? Yeah, stop! And she stood with the needle, and I said, now go, and let me talk to this man.
What did you say?
Who knows what I said? I comforted him. That is all. I was there. I stayed by him, and I told him that he would not go to hell, because I knew what a good man he was. Okay, he liked the Pilsner, and he smoked too much in the house, but finally, he was a kind person.
Too bad you couldn't remind him of the matzah story, because you didn't know about it. You could have comforted him with that story.
Exactly. What a bright little girl you are. He suddenly smiled and took a deep sigh, like relief, you know, and he said to me, you're right, Elsa, I will not go to hell, because I did something for God that only I could do. So, of course, I asked him what, but that was all. He mumbles something about a candle and fell back asleep, gentle like a child. And later, Fritz told me what he did, that man. It changed his life.
He went straight to heaven, I think. I hope he did. Maybe he'll meet Elijah there and the time of peace will come.
But for now, for right now, let's start the Seder. Pass the matzah plates around, Fritz. Everyone take a piece. The big ones are handmade the way Fritz's mother Lotte made them.
They did cost a fortune.
They are beyond price.
Yeah, beyond price. The bread of affliction that brings life.
It needs a little salt, this matzah.
Here, and soon we'll put horseradish on it to remind us of the slavery.
And after that, I have the best strawberry jam, the sweetest jam you ever tasted.
And now the blessing, everyone. Please repeat after me. Blessed art thou, O Lord.
Blessed art thou, O Lord.
Sovereign of the universe.
Sovereign of the universe.
Who has given us life. And sustained us and brought us to this day.
And sustained us and brought us to this day.
Now let's eat. I'm starving.
I want to thank Tom Robinson, president of the Community Players of Salisbury, and Rabbi Arnold Bienstock of the Beth Israel Congregation for their assistance with the production of this play, and offer a particular thanks to our cast, Judy Hearns as the mother, Sharona Gilson, Arnold Bienstock as the father, Jonathan Gilson, Hadass Bienstock as Hannah, Robert Forrester as Jesse, Susan Land as Sophie, Tom Welch as the guest, Frantz Kunkelstein, Angela Bird as his wife, Elsa Kunkelstein, Robert Forrester again doing double duty as the guard, Wolfgang Kunkelstein, and James Hatley as the prisoner, David Shimonis. This is your host, Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.